The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. This audiobook narration presents 1 minute mind reset, 7 60-second resets to interrupt overthinking at work topic introduction. It is 10:47 p.m. In a quiet room, lit only by the blue-white glare of a laptop screen, a professional sits perfectly still. For the last 23 minutes, they have been staring at a single, six-sentence email draft. The message is important, a response to a client whose feedback was both vague and critical. The cursor blinks at the end of the last sentence, a silent metronome marking time that has stalled completely. The professional has reread the draft a dozen times, then two dozen. Each pass is a forensic search for a hidden flaw, a misplaced comma, a turn of phrase that might be misinterpreted as defensive or worse, incompetent. With each reading, the imagined stakes seem to grow, while the words on the screen remain exactly the same. The jaw is tight, the shoulders are inching toward the ears, and the rest of the house has long since gone to sleep. This is not the careful, deliberate work of a high performer. This is a holding pattern. The mind is not solving a problem. It is running a frantic simulation of every possible negative outcome. It is a loop, and it is a scene playing out in countless home offices, late-night train commutes, and softly lit cubicles across North America every single day. This quiet, personal struggle is a symptom of a much larger condition. Modern professional life, with its relentless calendar pressure, constant digital messaging, an unspoken expectation to remain sharp no matter the circumstances, creates the perfect environment for the mind to get stuck. A shifting priority from leadership, a delayed reply after a tense meeting, or an ambiguous message from a colleague. These are not physical threats, yet the nervous system often treats them as such. The result is a silent epidemic of overthinking. Here, that term has a precise meaning. It is not deep, reflective problem-solving. Reflection is how we learn and improve. It produces traction. Overthinking is its unproductive counterpart, a repetitive mental replay that produces no forward motion. It simply circles, reopening the same mental file, rerunning the same conversation, and searching for a certainty that is not yet available. It is a state of cognitive friction, and it burns the finite mental resources needed for planning, prioritizing, and connecting with the people who matter most. The central question, then, is not one of character, but of mechanics. Why does the human brain, an organ optimized over millennia for survival and adaptation, fall into these self-defeating patterns? Why, precisely when clarity and action are needed most, does the mind choose to retreat into a loop of worry and replay? The answer lies not in a failure of willpower, but in our fundamental neurobiology. Research has identified a set of brain regions described as the default mode network, which becomes more active during self-focused thought and mental simulation. This network is essential for planning and learning. But when it stays dominant in the face of perceived uncertainty, it can suppress the task-positive networks responsible for focused, goal-directed action. In plain terms, the brain begins allocating its resources toward running an internal narrative rather than executing an external plan. This internal battle for resources is what many professionals experience as brain fog or decision fatigue. And it is a battle that thinking harder cannot win. This audiobook is built on a liberating premise. The most effective solution to overthinking is not to think more, but to interrupt the loop itself. It is based on the understanding that overthinking is a state, not an identity, and that state can be reliably changed with small, precise, and scientifically grounded actions. Over the next hour, we will explore 7 distinct resets, each designed to take no more than 30 and 60 seconds. These are not vague suggestions to just relax. They are a practical operating system for the mind, with each component targeting a specific mechanism that keeps the spiral in motion. They are built to fit into the cracks of a demanding day, whether in a hallway between meetings, in a parked car before walking into the office, or in the very moment the cursor begins to freeze over a difficult email. You will learn not only what to do, but why it works. From using the breath to downregulate the body's stress response, to using a simple planning formula to automate your next move. The goal is not to eliminate thought or to become a different person. It is to regain access to the focused, decisive, and present person who is already there, waiting for the noise to quiet. It is about learning to manage your own state, so that you can stop the workday from spilling over into your evenings, your relationships, and your peace of mind. The journey begins here, with the surprising truth that control is not a matter of force, but of knowing exactly where to place the briefest, most powerful interruption. End of introduction. The 1 minute mind reset addresses the reality of professional life in North America. Calendar pressure, constant messaging, high stakes, and the quiet expectation to stay sharp no matter what is happening internally. The promise is simple and practical. 7 1-minute resets fit into the cracks of a day, built to interrupt overthinking fast enough that decisions move again, work gets lighter, and the spillover into personal relationships softens instead of escalating. Overthinking needs an operational definition, because most people use the word to describe everything from being conscientious to being anxious. Here, overthinking means repetitive, unproductive mental replay that does not move toward a decision or an action. The mind circles. It reopens the same file. It reruns the same conversation. It searches for certainty that is not available yet. And it does all that while life keeps moving. That definition also creates a fair distinction. Reflective problem solving is not the enemy. Reflection is how strong professionals learn, prepare, and improve. The difference is whether thought produces traction. A simple workplace example makes the line visible. Imagine revising an important email with high visibility, potential for misunderstanding, and real consequences. Reflective problem solving looks like reading the message once, noticing the actual risk, and making a concrete adjustment. You might tighten one sentence, add a specific deadline, or choose a subject line that matches the ask. It moves forward. It may include a final check, but it ends when the message is ready to send. Rumination looks similar from the outside. You are still staring at the email, but it feels different on the inside. The mind keeps rereading the same lines, not to clarify meaning, but to reduce discomfort. It begins to predict reactions, replay past mistakes, and imagine how the email could be received in 10 different moods by 10 different people. The cursor moves, then freezes. The draft becomes a holding zone for anxiety. No new information arrives, yet the mental effort keeps burning resources. The urgency here is not a character critique. Overthinking is what the brain tends to do when uncertainty meets perceived threat. Work provides both, constantly. A shifting priority from leadership, a vague message from a client, or a delayed reply after a tense meeting do not constitute physical danger, but the nervous system often treats social and professional threat as real threat. When the brain cannot solve the problem immediately, it tries to solve the feeling of not knowing. That is the loop. The loop can get louder precisely when direct solutions are impossible. One reason is neurological. When the mind drifts into self-focused replay, a set of regions described as the default mode network becomes more active. Research identifies key nodes in that network, including the posterior cingulate cortex and parts of the medial prefrontal cortex. These regions support autobiographical thinking, self-evaluation, and mental simulation. Those are useful capacities. They are how a person plans, reflects, and learns. The problem begins when that internal network stays active while task-positive control networks struggle to fully engage. Task-positive networks, often discussed as frontoparietal control systems, support attention, working memory, and goal-directed action. In plain terms, they help a person pick the next step and execute it. When the default mode stays dominant, action feels harder, not because someone is lazy, but because the brain is allocating resources toward internal narrative rather than external control. That resource competition shows up as cognitive load inflation. Working memory is the limited mental space used to hold and manipulate information. Repetitive worry consumes that same space. The result is the experience many professionals describe as brain fog: slower thinking, reduced focus, and small memory lapses that feel out of character. When the mind is busy running internal simulations, fewer resources remain for planning, prioritizing, or even reading a page without having to reread it. Stress chemistry adds another layer. Cortisol is a central stress hormone, and public research summaries consistently describe its double edge. Brief elevation can sharpen attention, but prolonged elevation disrupts systems involved in memory and learning. The hippocampus appears especially sensitive. In daily life, that can look like walking into a meeting and forgetting what was just decided, or losing the thread of a thought mid-sentence. Overthinking often makes people feel as if they need to think harder, when what they actually need is to reduce physiological arousal so the thinking systems can come back online. Then there is the amygdala, the brain's rapid threat detection hub. When the amygdala flags danger, it can pull processing priority towards survival modes: scanning, reacting, preparing. This is the amygdala hijack idea in everyday form. The brain shifts resources away from the slower, deliberative capacities of the prefrontal cortex and toward faster protective responses. In a modern workplace, that can turn a minor ambiguity into a perceived emergency. The body revs, the mind loops, and decisions stall because the system is trying to get safe before it gets strategic. This is not niche. In workplace mental health reporting from 2025 and 2026, 74% of employees report negative mental health symptoms at work. That number is not a diagnosis, but it is a signal. The internal cost of modern work is widespread and affects attention, judgment, and relationships even among high performers. Other figures in the same research landscape describe majorities reporting burnout and only a small minority feeling comfortable discussing mental health concerns at work. This helps explain why so much overthinking stays private and untreated until it begins to shape performance. Time pressure makes it worse, but not in the way most people assume. Research across multiple countries points to a striking pattern. The feeling of being rushed predicts stress symptoms more strongly than actual clock time. Two people can have the same calendar load. One feels in control, the other feels hunted. That subjective feeling appears to matter because it is a threat cue. It tells the nervous system that mistakes are imminent. In that state, the mind replays, scans, and tries to prevent regret by thinking harder. The irony is that the loop itself becomes the thief of time. The aim is not to eliminate thought, but to interrupt the unproductive loop quickly, often in 60 seconds, so that decision-making restarts. The outcomes are practical: less decision delay, fewer reactive messages that need repairing later, and less spillover into the people who live with the aftershocks of a workday. Overthinking rarely stays neatly contained inside a job description. It follows people home in the tone of a reply, the tightness of a jaw, and the distracted half-presence at dinner. One suitability note is necessary. These resets are for everyday overthinking and stress loops. They are not a substitute for professional care. If anxiety, depression, panic, trauma symptoms, or compulsive rumination feel severe or unsafe, these tools can be supportive, but clinical help is the right next step. With that foundation in place, the first two habits begin where the fastest leverage usually lives: the nervous system. When the body settles, the mind becomes easier to steer. The first habit is the long exhale reset, and it uses 4-7-8 breathing. The structure is simple. Inhale for 4 seconds, hold for 7 seconds, exhale for 8 seconds. Three slow cycles take just under 1 minute. The headline is not the numbers, it is the ratio. The exhale is longer than the inhale, and that asymmetry is the point. Mechanistically, extended exhalation is one way to tilt the autonomic nervous system toward parasympathetic activity. The vagus nerve, the 10th cranial nerve, plays a central role here. It travels from the brainstem down through the body, connecting to organs involved in heart rate, breathing, and digestion. When vagal pathways are more engaged, physiological arousal tends to drop. Heart rate slows, breathing becomes more efficient, and the body signals safety upward to the brain. That shift does not solve the external problem, but it changes the internal conditions under which the problem is evaluated. This is why breathing can matter, even for people who think of themselves as purely cognitive. Overthinking is not only a thought problem, it is a state problem. Breath is one of the few levers that reliably influences state in real time. In research published across 2022 and 2023, structured breathing practices, including 4-7-8 patterns, are associated with improvements in markers such as heart rate variability and blood pressure. Heart rate variability refers to variation in the time between heartbeats. Higher variability is commonly associated in research literature with greater flexibility in autonomic regulation and better stress recovery. The point is not that 1 minute cures anxiety. The point is that 1 minute can shift the body enough to make the next choice more available. The practice takes 60 seconds. Sit or stand in a way that does not strain the chest or belly. Let the tongue rest gently and let the jaw loosen. Inhale through the nose for 4 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4. Hold for 7 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Exhale slowly for 8 seconds. If possible, exhale through the mouth with a soft, controlled stream. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Second cycle. Inhale for 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Hold for 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Exhale for 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Third cycle. Inhale for 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Hold for 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Exhale for 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. At the end, let breathing return to normal without forcing it. Notice the first small signal of settling. Shoulders dropping, hands warming, or a fraction more space behind the eyes. That subtle shift is enough. The goal is not sedation. The goal is regaining steering control. In a North American workplace, the best feature of this reset is that it is portable. It works in a hallway between meetings. It works in a restroom stall before walking back into a tense conversation. It works in a parked car before entering the building, especially on days when the body already arrives braced. It can even work at a desk with minimal visibility if the exhale stays quiet. Implementation matters because overthinking tends to appear when there is no time to remember tools. This habit becomes dramatically easier when it is stacked onto an existing transition. A clean option is to attach it to the end of meetings. The calendar chime hits, the meeting ends, and the first minute afterward is three cycles of long exhale breathing before opening the next tab. Another option is to attach it to the act of opening the calendar itself. The calendar is already a cue for pressure. Turning it into a cue for regulation changes the meaning of the moment. A common obstacle is self-consciousness in shared spaces. If that happens, the fix is not willpower. The fix is discretion. Keep the same timing, but breathe silently through the nose and let the exhale lengthen without making it obvious. The body still receives the message. To track whether the habit is working in real life, use a metric that is fast enough to be honest. Right after the third exhale, rate how quickly the body settles on a 0 to 10 scale, where 0 is not settled at all and 10 is noticeably calmer. The number does not need to be high. The value is in noticing change over time and in learning which environments and moments make the reset most effective. The second habit is the five senses switch, and it uses a 5-4-3-2-1 grounding pattern. Where the first habit downshifts physiology, this habit redirects attention. It moves awareness from the internal narrative back into immediate perception. The instructions are straightforward. Name five things that can be seen, then four things that can be felt, then three things that can be heard, then two things that can be smelled, then one thing that can be tasted. The deeper mechanism is attention competition. Overthinking is sticky because it feeds on internally generated content, images, predictions, self-talk. Grounding works by recruiting sensory processing and orienting systems that handle the here and now. It is not about pretending the problem is not real. It is about interrupting the brain's default tendency to treat internal thoughts as the most urgent stimulus in the environment. Research summaries on grounding and interoception support why this can help. Interoception is the sense of internal bodily state. When attention deliberately shifts into sensory channels, it can reduce the dominance of ruminative loops and make self-regulation easier. In plain terms, the mind cannot fully narrate and fully sense at the same time. Grounding is a practical way to force a channel switch. Start with vision. Identify five things that can be seen. Keep it simple and factual. A doorframe, a corner of a screen, a pen, a light reflection, a pattern in the floor. Move to touch. Identify four things that can be felt. The weight of the body in the chair. Feet inside shoes. Air on the skin. Fingers touching fabric. Move to sound. Identify three things that can be heard. Ventilation. Distant voices. A keyboard. Traffic outside. Move to smell. Identify two things that can be smelled. Coffee in the room, soap on the hands, paper. Even neutral office air counts if it is noticed clearly. Move to taste. Identify one thing that can be tasted. Mint, water, toothpaste. Or simply the baseline taste in the mouth. At the end, take one normal breath and notice whether the mental loop has loosened by even 5%. That is often enough to choose a next action rather than continuing to circle. This switch adapts beautifully to modern work moments. It can happen at a desk before sending a tense reply. It can happen during a transition walk when the mind is most likely to replay a conversation instead of preparing for the next one. It can happen while a file loads, while an elevator arrives, or while a meeting link opens. The genius is that it uses dead time to restore present time contact. The best cue for this habit is a specific, repeatable sign that overthinking has started. One of the most reliable is rereading. When the same sentence in a message thread gets read again, not for comprehension but for reassurance, that is the cue. Another cue is reopening the same tab repeatedly, looking for a new detail that is not there. When that cue appears, 5-4-3-2-1 becomes the automatic interrupt. Sometimes thoughts race too fast to complete the full count. In that case, shortening is not failure, it is calibration. Switch to 3-2-1 and prioritize touch and sound. Touch is immediate and stabilizing. Sound is hard to argue with. Three things that can be felt, two things that can be heard, one thing that can be seen, or any compact pattern that anchors attention in sensation instead of narration. The metric for the five senses switch is simple and surprisingly motivating. Keep a daily count of successful loop interruptions. Not minutes meditated, not perfect calm, just the number of times the spiral was caught and redirected. In a workday, even two or three interruptions can change the tone of a decision chain, because fewer spirals means fewer delayed replies, fewer avoidant tasks, and fewer messages sent from a narrowed threat state. These first two resets share a quiet promise. The goal is not to become a different person, but to regain access to the person who already exists when the nervous system is not blaring danger signals. Next comes a one-minute reset that turns predictable triggers into an if-then plan, so the interruption starts happening with less effort and less delay. A strange thing happens when a skill fits inside 60 seconds. It stops feeling like self-improvement and starts behaving like engineering. One small move, done in the same situation and the same way, teaches the brain a pattern. Then the next small move has something to attach to. That is the compounding effect in this entire approach. Each reset is useful on its own, but the bigger payoff is that these one-minute actions train cue and response. The cue becomes clearer. The response becomes faster. And over time, the brain stops negotiating. This matters because willpower is an unreliable fuel source in a modern North American workday. Motivation rises and falls with sleep, meetings, inbox volume, family logistics, and the emotional residue of whatever happened an hour ago. Habit, by contrast, runs on recognition. A cue appears, and the brain reaches for a learned sequence. That is not a moral claim. It is a wiring claim. In neuroscience terms, habit formation is often described as a shift in control. Early on, a new behavior leans heavily on the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that helps with planning, inhibition, and deliberate choice. That is the effortful phase. It is also the phase where people conclude they are failing because it still feels like work. With repetition, control progressively shifts toward the basal ganglia, a set of subcortical structures that specialize in pattern learning, especially cue-linked routines. The basal ganglia do not require inspiration. They require repetition that is consistent enough to recognize. This is why overthinking can feel so stubborn. Rumination is not only an idea, it is a practiced sequence. A trigger lands, an ambiguous message, a delayed reply, a calendar pile-up, and the brain runs a familiar routine involving replay, prediction, self-critique, and scanning for certainty. The loop may feel mental, but it behaves like a habit. Once that lands, a different strategy becomes available. The aim stops being to think better. The aim becomes to install a competing response. recent biology sharpens this picture even more. In December of 2025, research from Georgetown University Medical Center described a role for a protein called KCC2 in regulating dopamine neuron firing and the speed of reward learning, which is closely tied to habit formation. In that work, lower KCC2 levels are associated with faster dopamine neuron firing and faster learning of reward-linked associations, while higher KCC2 levels slow that learning. The practical takeaway is not that a single protein dictates destiny. It is that habit speed has biology under it, and that biology differs across people. Some brains lock in cue response pairings quickly. Others need more repetition before the pattern feels automatic. Dopamine sits at the center of this, because dopamine is less about pleasure than it is about learning what to repeat. It functions as a teaching signal, updating the brain's expectations about what actions are worth doing again. That is one reason cues become so powerful. When a cue reliably precedes a reward, relief, or even a short drop in discomfort, the brain tags the sequence as valuable. Overthinking often contains its own reinforcement. The mind replays because replay briefly creates the illusion of control. The brain learns that illusion the same way it learns anything else. So the plan in this audiobook stays deliberately humble. Instead of demanding a heroic personality, it leans on cues and repetition. Instead of asking for a new identity, it installs tiny defaults. These habits are built to be small enough that repetition is realistic, even under deadline pressure and social stress. A reality check helps set expectations. In a well-known longitudinal study of habit formation, the time it took for a behavior to feel automatic ranged from about 18 days to about 254 days, with an average around 66 days. That range is wide for a reason. Complexity matters. Context matters. Consistency matters. A habit that is one step and happens in a stable environment tends to become automatic faster than one that requires multiple steps and happens in chaotic circumstances. The most useful implication is simple. The calendar cannot be used as a verdict. A new reset may still feel deliberate at day 20, and that can still be normal learning. That same study also punctures one of the most discouraging myths in behavior change, the broken chain. The popular story says that missing a single day resets progress to zero. The data do not support that. In those records, missing one opportunity did not erase habit gains. Progress did not depend on perfection. It depended on returning. That matters for professionals because the workweek is not designed for perfect streaks. Travel happens. Kids get sick. Projects explode. A single miss is not a character flaw, and it is not a reset button. It is a moment. The pattern resumes with the next repetition. All of this leads to a more hopeful reframe. Rumination, when it becomes repetitive and unproductive, can be treated as a habit, not as a personal defect, and not as a life sentence. In rumination-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, rumination is targeted directly as a maintaining mechanism. A systematic review of that approach describes 12 randomized controlled trials, with outcomes that include reductions in rumination and depressive symptoms, relapse prevention, and durable gains at follow-ups that extend out to 3, 9, and 12 months in some research designs. Web-based versions in those summaries reduced depression risk by roughly one-third compared to usual care conditions, with estimates around 34 to 36% depending on the program and sample. The numbers matter because they point to something concrete, changing the process of rumination. How it runs, when it starts, what response follows. Changes outcomes more reliably than arguing with every individual thought. That is the hinge for the next 3 1-minute resets. The question becomes smaller and more tactical, and it lands at the midpoint of this program. What is the smallest cue-based change that can be installed today to break the attention loop? The third habit answers with a planning move that looks almost too simple to work until it is used under real pressure. The third habit is the if-then micro-plan. It is built on a research-backed concept called implementation intentions, which are specific plans that link a trigger to a next behaviour. The basic format is, if situation X happens, then behaviour Y happens. When this is done well, it reduces the intention-behaviour gap, the frustrating distance between knowing what to do and actually doing it in the moment. It also reduces decision load. The brain does not have to debate. The plan is pre-decided. Meta-analyses across health and performance domains consistently find that implementation intentions improve follow-through. The mechanism is not magic. It is timing. The plan is formed when the prefrontal cortex is calm enough to choose well, so that the basal ganglia can later run the sequence when the cue appears and stress is higher. Here is the 1 minute version, done in real time. First, pick one trigger that already happens in a normal workday. The trigger must be specific and observable. When anxiety hits is too vague. When the inbox opens is concrete. When a meeting ends is concrete. When the cursor hovers over, send and the chest tightens, is concrete. Second, choose one response that takes 1 minute or less. This matters more than it sounds. A response that is too big will trigger negotiation, and negotiation is where the loop restarts. The response should be so small it feels almost silly. One long exhale, one sentence written on paper. One calendar invite created. One draft opened with a single subject line typed. Third, rehearse the link once. Not 10 times. Once. The rehearsal is a quick mental run. Cue, then action. That single rehearsal helps the brain encode the contingency. A clean example in a North American workplace is email dread. The trigger might be if a high-stakes email is opened and the urge arises to reread the thread for the third time, then 3 long exhales happen before any further scrolling. That is not a full meditation practice. It is a 1 minute bridge back to control. Another example uses meeting transitions, which are some of the most underused cue moments in professional life. The trigger might be if a meeting ends and the next meeting is not yet opened, then 1 action sentence gets written. Not a plan, not a to-do list. 1 action sentence such as, send the revised timeline to the client, or ask for clarification on the scope. The point is to convert the fog into a next move while the window is open. The easiest way to make this automatic is to stack it on something that already has a rhythm. Morning coffee works because it is consistent. A recurring calendar event works because it is external and reliable. If the plan is attached to a recurring cue, the brain does not have to remember it from scratch. Troubleshooting for this habit is blunt because the failure mode is predictable. Scope creep kills the plan. The mind hears if then and tries to build a self-transformation project. That defeats the purpose. When the plan starts to expand, the fix is to force the response back into a single minute. 1 minute is small enough to repeat, and repetition is the entire engine. The metric is equally simple. Track daily adherence. Did the if-then response happen when the cue appeared? It can be a yes or no mark, once per day, for one plan. The payoff is clarity. A week of honest marks reveals whether the cue is well chosen, whether the response is too big, or whether the rehearsal needs to be refreshed. Once planning is installed, The next layer is what happens when thoughts themselves become sticky, when the mind produces a what if that feels urgent, or a should that feels like a verdict. That is where the fourth habit comes in. The fourth habit is label and release. It is a one-minute version of a process used in acceptance and commitment to therapy, often described as cognitive diffusion. The aim is to reduce fusion with thought content, meaning to stop treating every thought as a command, a fact, or a forecast. Thoughts can still appear. The change is in the relationship to them. The instruction involves two steps. First, name the thought pattern in a short phrase. Second, shift attention to a task cue. The label should be brief and slightly boring. What if spiral? Should story? Mind reading? Catastrophe draft? The words do not matter as much as the act of labeling. Labeling creates a sliver of distance, enough to restore choice. Then comes the release. Release does not mean forcing the thought away. It means redirecting attention to a cue that belongs to the present task. Breath is a strong option because it is always available. Sound is another, especially in an office environment where ventilation, hum, keyboard clicks, and hallway noise can be used as anchors. Here is the practice in 1 minute. When the sticky thought appears, silently label it. What if spiral? Or should story? Keep the label consistent so the brain learns it. Then take one slow breath and put attention on the exhale. If breath feels too loaded, shift to sound instead. Identify one continuous sound and follow it for 5 seconds. Return to the task cue. The next sentence to write, the next line to read, the next field to fill. This habit adapts well to high social pressure moments. Before speaking in a meeting, a surge of self-evaluation often arrives disguised as preparation. The label might be performance worry. The release is one exhale and eyes on the agenda line that matters. After ambiguous feedback, the mind tends to draft interpretations. The label might be mind reading. The release is attention to a concrete next step, such as writing a single clarifying question. Implementation becomes surprisingly precise when the cue is language. The habit can be cued by the appearance of certain phrases in the mind. When the words "what if" appear, label and release. When the word "should" appears, label and release. Those are common entry points into rumination, and they are easy to detect in real time. The troubleshooting move is to pair the label with one stabilizing question. What is the smallest useful action? Useful is the guardrail. It prevents the mind from using diffusion as avoidance. Sometimes a thought contains a real signal. The way to honor that signal without spiraling is to convert it into the smallest action that moves the situation forward. The metric for label and release is subjective, and that is fine because it is fast. After the minute, rate the stickiness of the thought on a 0 to 10 scale, where 0 is not sticky at all and 10 is glued. Over time, the number becomes a feedback tool. It shows which situations require extra structure, and it proves that thoughts can be present without being in charge. The fifth habit takes a different angle. Some worries do not dissolve with a label, especially when they involve real uncertainty, a project risk, a relationship tension, a budget decision, a performance review. The mind keeps reopening the file because it is afraid to forget it. The solution is not to keep thinking. The solution is to give the worry a container. The fifth habit is park it, then worry window. The 1 minute portion is park it. The worry window is the scheduled time later. Together, they break a powerful reinforcement loop. Unscheduled worry teaches the brain that worry is an anytime activity, Scheduled worry teaches the brain that worry has a place, and that the rest of the day is not it. Over time, postponement builds cognitive control, because it proves, through repetition, that attention can move without losing responsibility. The park. Its step happens in 1 minute. First, acknowledge the worry in a plain sentence. I am worrying about the client reaction. I am replaying the meeting exit. Avoid analysis, just name it. Second, write it down in a short line. Not paragraphs, one line. Third, schedule it. Pick a specific time for the worry window, usually 10 to 30 minutes, and choose a location if possible. The scheduling matters because it signals commitment. The brain relaxes when it believes the issue will not be dropped. Fourth, close the worry note. Physically close the notebook, minimize the document, or put the note in a designated place. Then return to the task queue. The next email, the next line of work, the next concrete step. Evidence from cognitive behavioral therapy research supports scheduled worry time as a way to reduce overall anxiety and rumination. The logic is practical. Worry is reinforced when it feels protective. Postponement removes the immediate payoff. The mind learns that the day can continue even with uncertainty present, and that the worry can be handled later in a bounded way. In workplace terms, this is a powerful response to project risk spirals. A risk appears, and the mind tries to solve the entire future at once. Park. It captures the risk, schedules a review, and returns attention to what can be done now. It also helps with late-night conversation replays, where the mind keeps editing what should have been said. The replay can be parked with a note and scheduled, so sleep is not used as a negotiation table. The cue for this habit is repetition. When the same worry content repeats twice, that is the sign that thinking is no longer producing traction. That is the moment to park it. The troubleshooting step is important because some worries require action now. The fix is not to abandon postponement. The fix is to add one action line next to the worry if immediate action is genuinely needed. One call to schedule. One clarification email. One document to pull. Then the rest goes into the worry window. This preserves responsiveness without letting the mind turn the entire day into open-ended rumination. The metric is time-based and revealing. Estimate minutes of unscheduled worry versus scheduled worry. No stopwatch is needed. A rough daily estimate is enough. When unscheduled minutes drop and scheduled minutes become contained, attention returns to the work and to the people outside work. The numbers show that control is increasing, even if the mind still produces worried thoughts. By the end of these three habits, the pattern should feel clearer. A cue appears and a small trained response takes over. Plan, diffuse, contain. So the loop loses momentum before it becomes the whole day. Next, come two final one-minute resets that tighten attention even further and make the system easier to run when stress is high and time is short. High-pressure weeks have a way of shrinking the mind. The calendar tightens, messages stack up, and every decision starts to feel like it carries heavy consequences. In that kind of stretch, these one-minute resets stop being techniques and start acting like a personal operating system. They become small defaults that keep attention and action online when the day tries to push both into a loop. At this point, the menu is complete enough to feel like a system. One set of resets calms the nervous system fast, so the body stops broadcasting danger signals. Another switches attention out of internal replay and back into the room. Another automates a next move with if-then planning, so a cue triggers action instead of negotiation. Another diffuses sticky thoughts, so they stop masquerading as commands. Another postpones worry into a container, so the brain can stand down without feeling irresponsible. The last two do something slightly different. They unload what is clogging working memory, and they time box decisions so they stop consuming the entire day. The sixth reset is externalize in 60. Overthinking often persists for a simple reason. The mind is trying not to drop something important. It keeps replaying a conversation because it fears forgetting the best explanation. It keeps scanning a risk because it fears missing a detail. The loop feels irrational, but the intent is protective. Externalize in 60 takes that protective intent seriously and gives it a better tool than mental rehearsal. The instruction is plain. In 60 seconds, record either a short voice memo or a four-line note. Not a paragraph and not a journal entry. Just four lines where each line has a specific job. The first line is the worry, stated in a fragment. The second line is the constraint, or the real limit that shapes what can happen next. The third line is the next action, something doable in under 5 minutes. The fourth line is the stop point, the moment when thinking ends for now and attention returns to the day. That structure matters because it converts a shapeless cloud into an object. Once it is an object, it can be handled. The mechanism here is working memory relief. Working memory is not only small, it is expensive. When worry stays internal, it competes with everything else. Reading, listening, prioritizing, even remembering why a tab was opened in the first place. Cognitive psychology describes a simple effect where the mind can use its limited workspace for the next step instead of for repetitive holding once information is stored outside the head. That is cognitive offloading. There is also a second mechanism that feels subtle but is often decisive. Distance. When a worry is expressed as a note, especially in short, almost blunt fragments, it becomes slightly less fused to the self. It is no longer a fog that fills the entire mind. It is a few lines on a page or a short recording that can be replayed later. Research on expressive writing and emotion labeling supports this general direction. Putting concerns into words can reduce the strain of carrying them, even when the external situation is not immediately solvable. The goal is not catharsis. The goal is capacity. To practice this in 1 minute, act as if it is happening in real time. Start by choosing the format, either a voice memo or four lines. Voice works well when typing feels like effort, while a note works well when privacy is needed. Now write or say the first line, using fragments only. Worry. Client response. Misunderstanding. Reputation. The second line is the constraint. Cannot control timing. Need facts first. Reply must be calm. The third line is the next action, doable in under 5 minutes. Open draft. Write subject line. Add one clarifying sentence. Alternatively, send one question to confirm scope, or pull the file and highlight the one number needed. The fourth line is the stop point. Stop after the draft is saved. Revisit at 3:30 p.m. Or stop after the question is sent. No rereading the thread. Then close it. Put the note where it will be found later, or end the voice memo. Return to the nearest concrete task queue, even if the queue is small, like opening the draft or writing the first neutral sentence. That last piece, the stop point, is what turns this from venting into an operating system. It tells the brain, with evidence, that responsibility has been preserved and attention is allowed to move on. In a North American workplace, this reset shines in two recurring moments. The first is the aftermath of a tense call. A call ends, and the mind starts rebuilding it from scratch. What was implied, what should have been said, or what the other side might do next. Externalize in 60 is a clean exit ramp. The worry is captured, the constraint is acknowledged, One next action is chosen, and the replay is given a stop point. The second moment is before sending an emotional message. The cursor hovers over send, and the mind begins to rewrite the whole relationship in one paragraph. Externalize in 60 creates a pause without turning the pause into more rumination. It lets the message become a task again. The best cue is surprisingly specific, mentally rehearsing explanations. When the mind starts practicing the same justification, how to explain a delay, a mistake, or a boundary, that rehearsal is often a sign that working memory has become a stage. That is the moment to externalize. A common troubleshooting issue is perfectionism. The mind tries to turn four lines into literature, and then nothing gets written. The fix is almost comically strict. Ban complete sentences and force fragments. Worry, budget pushback. Constraint, waiting on approval. Next action, draft two options. Stop point, after calendar hold. Fragments bypass the part of the brain that wants to make it beautiful. The point is function. The metric for this habit is simple and honest. Count daily instances of capturing actions outside the head. Not total tasks completed, but captures. The count is proof that working memory is being protected. Over time, a higher capture count tends to correlate with less mental replay, because fewer open loops are being carried internally. The seventh reset is the 1 minute decision time box. Overthinking does not only loop on worries, it also loops on choices. The brain compares options that are not meaningfully different, it waits for perfect certainty, and it burns the same fuel that will be needed later for genuinely hard calls. The 1 minute decision time box is designed for the decisions that are small enough to choose, but sticky enough to drain the day. The instruction has four moves. Set a timer for 1 minute. Define what good enough means for this decision. Choose one step. Commit, either by doing the step immediately or by scheduling the next moment when the decision will be completed. The mechanism is decision fatigue management. The prefrontal cortex carries a lot of the load for deliberation, inhibition, and effortful choice. When fatigue builds, especially late in the day, prefrontal engagement weakens, and the mind becomes less willing to exert effort. In a functional magnetic resonance imaging study published in 2025, fatigue is associated with reduced prefrontal engagement and a reduced willingness to choose harder, more rewarding options. The practical implication is almost relieving. The hesitation is not moral failure. It is a predictable energy pattern. Time pressure adds another twist. Under time pressure, decision accuracy can decline, even in skilled performers. Research using time-constrained choice tasks shows that compressed windows can narrow what the brain processes, increase reliance on shortcuts, and reduce accuracy. The 1 minute decision time box uses a controlled version of time pressure. It is not a panic sprint, but a deliberate boundary that prevents endless comparison. To practice this, start by naming the decision in a short phrase. Agenda order for tomorrow. Whether to escalate the conflict, which draft to send, which task comes next. Now set the 1 minute timer. Define good enough with one criterion. A single criterion is the guardrail. Good enough means it reduces risk. Or good enough means it is reversible. Or good enough means it serves the deadline. Or good enough means it protects the relationship. Choose the next step, not the perfect plan. Book the meeting. Send the clarifying question. Pick option A and draft the first line. Decide to wait until the data arrives and schedule the decision. Then commit. If the step takes under 2 minutes, do it now. If not, schedule the follow-up in a concrete way a calendar hold, a reminder, or a clearly defined next time the decision will be revisited. When the minute ends, stop. The boundary is the medicine. Without the boundary, the mind will keep shopping for certainty it cannot buy. In the workplace, this reset has two powerful uses. One is meeting design. Agendas often get overthought because they are social and visible. A one-minute time box forces a pragmatic choice. What is the first item that will make the rest of the meeting easier? Choose that, then move. The other use is conflict escalation. Many professionals lose hours debating whether to raise a concern, how to phrase it, and when to do it. The time box does not solve the entire social complexity. It chooses a step. Sometimes the step is simply scheduling a private conversation. Sometimes it is drafting a neutral, fact-based note and letting it sit. Sometimes it is deciding not to escalate yet and setting a clear review time so postponement does not become avoidance. The best cues are behavioural, not emotional. Reopening the same tabs is one. If the same three tabs are opened again, the mind is often pretending to re-urge while actually avoiding a choice. Another cue is end-of-day planning, when fatigue is high and small decisions start to sprawl. The time box protects the last hour of the day from turning into a swamp of half-choices. Troubleshooting starts with one question. Is this decision reversible? If it is reversible, lower the stakes. Choose the option that meets good enough and move. Reversible decisions are experiments. The cost of delay is often higher than the cost of a less than perfect choice. If it is irreversible or high impact, the time box still works, but the commitment changes. Instead of forcing a final decision, commit to the next information step and the next decision point. Call legal tomorrow. Get one estimate. Ask for one data point. The one-minute boundary prevents endless rumination while still respecting the stakes. The metric here is personal and revealing. Estimate minutes lost to indecision on low-stakes choices. Do this once at the end of the day, as a rough number. When that estimate starts dropping, the time box is doing its job. It is turning mental friction back into forward motion. To make these last two resets feel real, consider a fictional composite drawn from common patterns in North American professional life. This composite professional is competent, conscientious, and reliable. The baseline pattern is not chaos, it is friction. After tense interactions, the mind replays the call while trying to write the next email. Small choices stall because each option gets weighed as if it predicts the future. The work still gets done, but it takes longer than it should. At home, the spillover looks like distraction and irritability. Conversations get half attention. Small misunderstandings linger because the mind is still at work, still drafting explanations. A work crisis arrives in a familiar form. A project complication paired with ambiguity from a stakeholder. The mind starts running the old loop, rehearsing what to say, imagining pushback, reopening the thread, rereading the same lines. This time, the first successful reset is not a dramatic moment. It is a 60-second externalization on a voice memo right after the tense call ends. The memo is rough. It captures the worry, the constraint, a next action that is actually doable, and a stop point. The next action happens quickly. A single clarifying question gets sent. The stop point is honoured. The replay is not gone, but it is quieter because responsibility has been recorded. Over the next 2 weeks, small wins accumulate in a way that feels almost mechanical. Externalise in 60 gets used after emotionally charged moments, and the daily capture count becomes a quiet scorecard. the one-minute decision TimeBit gets used when tabs start reopening, and when end-of-day planning begins to sprawl. Some days the resets happen once. Some days they happen several times. Skipped days occur, because real life does not run on perfect streaks. But the overall trend is clear. Fewer loops get carried internally, and more decisions get moved into action or into scheduled follow-ups. The outcomes show up in two measurable places: replay time and decision delay. Replay time shrinks because worries are being contained and offloaded instead of rehearsed. Decision delay shrinks because good enough is being defined and the next step is being chosen. Work feels lighter not because demands vanish, but because cognitive load is no longer being spent on endless holding and comparing. At home, the difference is not a personality transplant. It is availability. Less mental replay means more presence. Fewer delayed decisions means fewer last-minute scrambles that poison the evening. When pressure hits and a reset is needed immediately, a short checklist can run like a script. Step one is to pause with a one-minute anchor. That can be three long exhales, a short sensory switch, or any one reset that reliably returns you to the room. Step two is to label the pattern. Replay. Tab reopening. What if spiral? The label is a handle, and handles make patterns easier to move. Step three is to time box or defer. If the issue must be handled, time box the decision for 1 minute. If it can wait, park it and schedule a container so the brain stops treating it as urgent background noise. Step four is to choose one micro action. One email subject line. One clarifying question. One calendar hold. One document opened and named. The action is the hinge between thought and traction. Step five is to reset and re-engage. Close the note, end the memo, end the minute. Return to the next concrete task queue with the smallest possible step. For daily implementation in a North American workday, habit stacking keeps this simple. Morning arrival is a natural anchor for one small if-then plan because it sets a default before the first wave of messages. Meeting endings are anchors for externalization, because the mind is most likely to replay as soon as social pressure lifts. Before sending high emotion messages is an anchor for a 60-second note, because the stop point prevents endless editing. Tab reopening is an anchor for the 1 minute decision time box, because it catches indecision in the act. End of day planning is an anchor for a final time box, because fatigue makes small choices expensive. Tracking should stay light enough to survive real life. One daily rating and one count is enough. Use one rating to capture loop load at the end of the day on a 0 to 10 scale, where 0 means the mind felt mostly clear and 10 means replay dominated. Then use one count. How many times was something captured outside the head? That can include worry notes, voice memos, or quick decision commitments. The rating shows the felt experience. The count shows behavior. Together, they reveal whether the operating system is being used. When stress is extremely high, the mind often resists anything that looks like a process. In that state, simplify. Choose the most discreet, least complex move. Fragments in a note. Not paragraphs. One criterion for good enough, not three. One next step, not a plan. Under high stress, smaller is not weaker. Smaller is executable. In public environments, privacy matters. A voice memo might be awkward. A four-line note can be typed as a draft message to yourself, written on paper, or captured as a title-only note that can be expanded later. The goal is externalization, not performance. Skipped days are inevitable. The fix is not guilt. The fix is a clean restart queue. Choose one queue that happens every day, opening the calendar, ending the first meeting, sitting down to write, and treat it as the restart point. Progress comes from returning, not from never missing. All seven resets point to the same outcome: regaining choice over attention and action. Overthinking feels like the mind has seized the steering wheel. These habits give the steering wheel back 1 minute at a time, with mechanisms that respect how the brain actually works under pressure. The practical next step is to use the immediate checklist and choose one daily habit to run for the next 2 weeks. This is long enough to feel the difference between knowing a reset and having it available on demand. To capture the promise in under a minute, this is the essence. Overthinking is not a character flaw. It is a loop that burns working memory and delays decisions. A 1 minute reset interrupts the loop fast enough to restore traction. It calms the body, switches attention, automates a next step, diffuses sticky thoughts, contains worry, unloads what the mind is carrying, and time boxes decisions so they stop expanding. The result is practical. Fewer delayed replies, fewer reactive messages, and more presence when the workday ends. The core of this approach remains simple. The 1 minute mind reset is a science-backed set of seven micro habits for busy North American professionals who overthink under pressure. Each reset takes about 60 seconds and targets a specific mechanism, from nervous system regulation to decision fatigue. The focus is not motivation or mindset. It is a practical operating system for getting attention and action back, even on the busiest days. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.